Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. I'll be talking with actor Francis Ju and playwright Lauren Yee about the production of King of the Yees at SF Playhouse. It's a play set in and around San Francisco's Chinatown that was inspired by Yee's family and their deep connections in the community. I'll also talk with producer Kate Duhamel and Yasu band member James Jackson about Fury, an immersive concert dance experience which combines the music of indie pop band Yasu and string composer Christina Dutton with a number of world-class dancers and is inspired by the movie Mad Max Fury Road. Also joining me in studio will be ACT's new artistic director, Pam McKinnon. She's making her directorial debut as well at the company with Edward Albee's Seascape, his Pulitzer Prize-winning play from 1975, which is a wildly imaginative and satirical comedy in which a newly retired couple picnic and squabble on a beach about their life together, and they're interrupted by two human-sized English-speaking lizards. You want to hang around for this conversation today on Open Air. San Francisco Playhouse presents King of the Yees by Bay Area playwright Lauren Yee. It's a biographical drama based on the life of Lauren's father, Larry, who was a driving force in the Yee Family Association in San Francisco's Chinatown, an organization that was formed some 150 years ago in the wake of the Gold Rush. Award-winning playwright Lauren Yee's plays have been produced by the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, La Jolla Playhouse, Denver Center, Seattle Rep, ACT, among many others. This is her second production for the Playhouse, having had her award-winning In a Word receive its world premiere as part of the Playhouse's Sandbox series. And she joins me in studio. Welcome, Lauren.
Hi there. Thanks for having us.
Playing Larry Yee is Francis Ju, who was last seen here in San Francisco in the amazing production of Soft Power at the Curran. He's been seen on Broadway and Pacific Overtures, Thoroughly Modern Millie, and M. Butterfly. Won a slew of awards, which would take up the rest of the hour to list, so I'll just say that he's you should come see this gentleman for his both stage work, and he's also been seen in recurring roles on TV for Madam Secretary, Law and Order, SVU, and The Good Wife. Francis, welcome to you.
So happy to be here.
Happy to have you. Well, Lauren, I think most people have only a modest knowledge, if any at all, of the various family associations that are a part of the fabric of Chinatown. Tell us about them.
So basically, you know, 100, 150 years ago, thanks to the Chinese Exclusion Act, all of, you know, the Chinese-American men who were living in this country were basically bachelors, that the law forbid them from bringing their wives, their children. And so I feel for company, they form these clubs based on last names, you know, in order to create some sense of community around them at the time. And so, you know, for every Chinese last name, Wong, Yi, Lum, you had just this association of people who were kind of like-minded and provided, you know, company in a country that, you know, oftentimes felt hostile to you. However, those clubs have persisted to today, even though now kind of their original purpose is to provide, you know, company in the face of having no family, is largely obsolete. And I think one thing that I always experienced growing up was, you know, what are these associations for? My father joined it because his father had been a member, because his father had been a member. You know, but what do you do with an association of Yee men, you know, in 2019?
Interesting. Now, you say Yee men, or like you mentioned, Wong men.
Yeah.
these are probably people that aren't necessarily related to each other. They just have the same common last name. Is that how that works? Or is it all of a deep familial connection?
Well, if you ask my father, all Yees,
Francis,
36 generations go back to a single original Yee, who did a great service to the emperor and was granted his own last name to start his own branch. So if you believe that family lore, we all descend from a single Yi. Is that true? Debatable. And I think that's like where this play King of the Yees lives. It lives, you know, within the stories that my father told me growing up, and just the family history that gets passed down, you know, in every family.
So what does make the Yee family association distinctive?
That's a good question. In certain ways, you know, one thing that's kind of really interesting about this is that, you know, there's a family association for every last name, that if you walk through San Francisco Chinatown, you'll see the doors, Wong Family Association, Yee Family Association. Hmm. And so, you know, it's not that the Yees are different from any of these other family last names. You know, that's my particular family's last name. And so, you know, we have our own lore associated with it.
Mm-hmm. And I think some of the common, you know, the common street lore, too, stems from bad publicity in terms of gang relationships as well in some of these family associations that are, that's the stuff that makes the paper rather than the charitable work or the social work that they do.
And just to clarify, the Yee Family Association, we are not a gang. We are a benevolent family association. That does this charitable work.
Right.
We have no association, you know, to these other organizations.
So don't call the studio and complain. Is that
no?
Right? No, I think. But the other perception of even of Chinatown, mm-hmm, comes from the stereotype of a Rodgers and Hammerstein production of Flower Drum Song, rather than the deeper family ties that are a part of these associations.
Yeah, and I think what the play deals with a lot is that the idea of Chinatown has always been, you know, fabricated or fictitious. Like from the beginning, you know, at the turn of the century, Chinatown, you know, from the outside, was viewed as like a dirty, dangerous place to be. And what happened with the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco was that, you know, Chinatown, like a lot of the city, got, you know, burned to the ground, and the Chinese American community had to rebuild. And I think really smartly they said, this is an opportunity to kind of make a Chinatown that's for tourists. We're going to rebuild Chinatown, but we're going to rebuild it with pagodas and dragons. And so if you walk along Grant and you kind of see all these like beautiful buildings, they've been built very specifically with the tourists in mind, because they wanted to show, you know, the other people living in San Francisco, know that the Chinese American community is not to be feared. We're not dangerous. Like, we're fun. You should come here and eat the food. You know, so like since 1906, the idea of like what Chinatown is has been, you know, a little bit fabricated.
Mm-hmm. So what of the rich family lore that you inherited from your father, how did you develop this into a through line for a play?
So one of the things that I got to do was that whenever I was in a major American city that had a Yee Family Association, I went. Basically, I asked my father, like, connect me to whoever is your counterpart there. And so in Phoenix, in Chicago, in New York, I would meet the doppelganger of my father, mm-hmm, in that particular town. And it was actually kind of it was a wonderful way to get to know my dad, because every time I would go to one of these cities, the person didn't know me, they'd never met me, but they would pick me up from the airport, they would give me water, they would take me to a dinner of like 20 people that I'd never met, all because I was Larry's daughter.
Wow.
And we were Yees. And it was like all the things that my father had told me growing up were true. He's like that there are bonds between Yees and that this is important. And it's stuff, you know, I think every family has this, that you hear things growing up, and then, you know, as an adult, you kind of get to see your parent in a new light, and you get to kind of see what their impact on a community has been, and the things that they always told you that you're like, oh, actually, that is kind of true. And so this play was a great way, you know, to get to know my father and also really become part of the Yi Family Association, which I never would have anticipated.
Mm-hmm. That's Lauren Yi. Her King of the Yis is having its world premiere at SF Playhouse through March 2nd. Also now talking with Francis Ju, who plays Larry Yi, Lauren's dad. Francis, I still have such strong memories of your appearance in Soft Power. Amazing production that was, and such creative writing involved in that. Congrats again on that production.
Thank you.
So before we get into your role at the Playhouse, what have been some of your career highlights since then, before coming out back out here?
Oh, wow. Since Soft Power, I also did a new production of Wild Goose Dreams, a new play by Hansel Jung, at the Public Theater. I have a recurring role as Minister Chen on Madam Secretary, so I've shot a number of episodes for that. But, you know, I have to say, ever since doing Soft Power in San Francisco, all I've really been looking forward to is doing King of the Yis back here in San Francisco. And coming back, I had such a great time performing for family and friends. And I've been looking forward to doing this play, King of the Yis, in front of family and friends, because it is so much a love letter to San Francisco. In some ways, as much as I've gotten to know the Yis through the show, I feel like it's a love letter to my own family as well, and the way that I grew up, that previous generations in my family grew up. And so coming back here has really been a dream come true.
Terrific. And you're, as I mentioned, you're playing Lauren's dad, Larry Yi.
I am the king.
Yes, the king. So in developing the character, you obviously have the ultimate source material in his daughter, Lauren here. Has she helped you shape your characterization?
Absolutely. You know, first, I just have to say, I'm not trying to do an imitation of her actual father. I when I first started working on the role, I hadn't met her father yet. And so all I had was this character that she had written in the play, which I think captures the essence of her father, Larry. But I am nothing like her father, who is a really handsome, tall man with a full head of hair, and I am none of those things.
Oh, you got the handsome going.
thank you. So there are many people who would disagree. I would constantly ask Lauren in rehearsal, am I going too far with this guy? He's a very generous soul. He's gregarious, and I tend to be rather shy. And so I would ask Lauren if I was going too far, and she just kept encouraging me to go further, because I've learned, especially after meeting him, that Larry is one of the most generous people I've ever met, and there's a reason why he is such a leader in his community and why he has the trust of the people in his community. He's a fabulist. He creates stories and histories, and you tend to believe them because he believes them so much.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, he and Lauren gave us a tour of Chinatown, took us out to dim sum, and gave us a tour of Chinatown and the Yi Family Association. And we were stopped numerous times by people in the community just saying, "Hey, Larry," and we got free fortune cookies at the Golden Gate Fortune Cookie Factory because we were with Larry. He's just engenders, I think, such a generosity of spirit because of who he is.
So that leads to me to my next question, which was answered. Larry is still very much alive and with us.
Yes, he's very much alive. He saw the show. Yes.
He is very much with us, as are so many Yis who have come to see the show. I got to tell you, there are plenty of ye family members who want to join us on stage every night.
That's great. Tell us a little bit more about who we will meet in The King of the Yees.
Oh, I don't want to give it away too much because I feel like this play, in a way, is almost like one of those magical boxes that you get and it opens and it continues to open. And, you know, I think for an audience, the joy of the piece is that you kind of don't, like China, like a trip through Chinatown, you don't know who you're going to meet or what's going to happen or where it's going, but you know it's going to be incredibly rich and exciting and kind of like warm. But you definitely meet a version of my father and a version of myself. And you also have this like really wonderful ensemble of three actors who play everyone else in Chinatown.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is like, I feel like such a feast for actors because like you see them and they just walked off one way and they come in, you know, from a completely different direction in a completely different costume. And I think early on it was really a choice to figure out how to make you feel like you're walking through San Francisco Chinatown.
Nice.
I'll say too that Lauren does this amazing thing where she introduces characters, introduces Chinatown, and you think you know what you're going to get because of our own expectations, because of our own perceptions of these people, of these characters, and constantly she is defying everybody's expectations of who those people are in their essence, of what Chinatown is. And a lot like anybody's relationship with their child or with their parent, where you think you've got them pegged, you think you know their story, and they just keep surprising you. And I think it's one of the things that more people than not have remarked on after the show is how, whether they're Chinese or not, they recognize their father in Larry or they recognize their child in Lauren.
Very much a patriarchal play then. What are some of the female characters involved in the show?
Oh, I mean, there's me.
Okay.
yes.
She's the lead.
I am a character in the play. And I think, you know, we just have like a wide range of characters, you know, played by our ensemble of three. Mm-hmm. And I think going off of like Francis's point too, I think there's something in it for everyone. I think it's a particular treat if you're from San Francisco. It's a particular treat, you know, if you're, for instance, Asian American or Chinese American, you know, if you kind of grew up living in Chinatown or visiting Chinatown. But I think at the same time, it's a story about what it's like to reconcile with your parents as adults. That I think everyone has that version of, you know, kind of that painful break that you have to make with your parents. Even if you have a great relationship with them, there's kind of this distance that exists and that you have to come back home and say, this is who I am and this is what my life is. And I think, you know, that's true, you know, whether like me, you were born in San Francisco and I live in New York now, or whether, you know, you were born in San Mateo and now you live in Antioch and your mm-hmm. parents are like, you never visit.
You Universal know,
I,
themes.
I think that's true for everybody.
Yeah, yeah. Did your dad provide any pushback after he saw the play or as you were developing the mm-hmm. play? Why didn't you include this or no, this is all wrong? Or
So I think like one of the great things about my father, which I feel like is reflected in the play, is that I think he's all about his kids. That he's like, okay, how can I be useful? How can I, you know, support you? So I think, you know, it is a big thing and perhaps like a scary thing to see a version of yourself put on stage by your child. But I think at the same time, he's never said, please don't do that, or you can't write this. It's very much been like, you're going to tell the story that you need to tell, you know, and I'm going to be here to help you, you know, tell that story. I think he almost views himself, you know, as an ambassador for the play, that he's all about, like, well, if you're going to have this play, we got to make it a success. We got to bring in audiences. You know, and we got to show your actors the whole experience. So I think, you know, he's always been really supportive, even as I think he's a little delighted, but also a little mortified to see himself on stage.
Lauren Yee, starring in and the author of King of the Yees, or at least her character is in the play, also joined by Francis Chu, who is King Yee, so to speak, playing Lauren's dad. So we have the playwright there for her input. What sort of input did the director Joshua Kahan Brody bring to the equation?
Yeah.
How did he help fine-tune the show?
Josh has been wonderful in this piece that, you know, we've known each other for a very long time, and he knows my father, he knows me. I think he is also one of those people who is wonderful at creating community and really leaving space to bring out the best in people, that he says to actors, okay, here's the playing space, like, fill it. And so to me, the play is so incredibly funny and generous and warm, you know, in large part because of his presence. And I think that's like a very valuable thing, because this play should feel like coming home in a way. It should be like walking into, you know, your childhood home and having dinner with your family and having it being noisy and stressful and wonderful in all the right ways.
Mm-hmm. Francis Chu, the show is opened. Is it now set in stone, or is there still some wiggle room for changing things around a little bit night to night?
We opened last weekend, and we added a couple of new lines just last night.
Yeah.
So, you know, with a lot, you know, comedy is hard. To make it seem spontaneous and still maintain like the show as written is really, really hard, especially when the audience is a member of the company on stage with us every night. And what Josh did was he allowed us to play, and he maintained a real rigor about keeping it real, even when it was, when the play just flies off the rails. And at the same time, you know, I think he set the boundaries within which we could keep inventing and keep responding honestly. And I got to say, you know, every audience responds differently, and we've got to help guide them towards home plate at the end of the mm-hmm. of the play, no matter where they're coming from and what they choose to respond to. And it's been wild with San Francisco audiences in particular, who have really strong associations and feelings about the things that are mentioned in the play, about the real people, the real events that happen in the play. It's been a great joyride, actually, mm-hmm. Trying to read every audience and bring them home.
Lauren Yee's King of the Yees is at SF Playhouse, a wonderful house to play in, by the way, through March 2nd, sfplayhouse.org for more information. Starring Francis Chu, the story of the King of the Yees, Lauren's dad, Larry Yee. Thank you both for coming in today. I look forward to catching the show at this love letter to San Francisco.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Of course. Well, still to come, Pam McKinnon, the new artistic director of ACT, will be in to talk about her artistic directorship and her directorship of the ACT production of Edward Albee's Seascape, an amazing production you're really going to want to catch at the Geary Theater here in San Francisco. Well, next we have something a little bit different and post-apocalyptic, I think we can call it. Fury is an immersive concert experience which fuses the music of indie pop band Yasu and string composer Christina Dutton. It's created with dancers from two world-class ballet companies, San Francisco Ballet and Alonzo King Lines Ballet. It's a concert experience that takes you on a musical journey inspired by the iconic movie Mad Max Fury Road. Joining me in studio to talk about the show is Yasu, musician James Jackson and filmmaker Kate Duhamel, the producer of Fury. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Of course. Mad Max is such a part of the cultural zeitgeist, but there may be people that are not familiar with the story, so perhaps you can keep us apprised of what the whole storyline around Mad Max was, and then we can talk about the interpretation that you offer, Kate.
Sure. The Mad Max story really is an adventure movie, and we in particular are inspired by the last movie called Mad Max Fury Road, which Charlize Theron starred in. We do follow a similar story arc to the movie, which is that she has escaped from the Citadel, where the antagonist, a person named Immortan Joe, has captured all the women and is depriving the people of their water. And so he's essentially a horrible dictator, and he's imprisoning women and using them to, have his babies, etc. So Charlize Theron plays the character Furiosa, which in our show is danced by a woman named Aji Sissoko, an incredible ballerina with Lines Ballet. And she escapes in this huge truck called the War Rig, and she takes five of the wives with her. This is in the movie. And they take off across the desert to hopefully find what she calls the Green World, which is the world prior to the apocalypse and prior to the takeover of Immortan Joe, to his takeover of the whole community or people. And so she takes off across the desert. Meanwhile, Mad Max also has he's living a feral life out in the desert without really connection to anybody. And he's captured by Immortan Joe, by one of his deputies, who's a character named Nux, who is danced by Michael Montgomery from Lines Ballet as well. Nux needs a blood donor to be healthy, be a healthy fighter. And so he captures Max, who happens to be O negative, and therefore connects himself to Max to have a healthy blood supply so that he can be a healthy fighter. So he joins Immortan Joe as they all take off across the desert to recapture Furiosa and his wives that she has hidden in her huge truck to escape with. And so that's where our story begins. Our story begins when Furiosa leaves the Citadel and takes the wives with her. There's a huge battle in the desert, which is portrayed through dance and music in our show Fury. And then what happens is they basically survive the first battle. As I said before, Furiosa is taking off to reconnect with and find the world that was left behind, that she grew up in, that has water and people and love and, a beautiful sort of childhood memory. Max catches up with them midway through the show, and he basically first he and Furiosa are fighting with each other, but he convinces her that she has to turn back, that there is no green world, that that's a fantasy that doesn't exist anymore, and that she's chasing a dream that is futile. And so it's a huge, difficult realization for Furiosa that not only is the place that she has always dreamed of returning to gone, but it's also, a complete impossibility to recapture anything like that. Meanwhile, Nux is going back and forth between being a bad guy and being a good guy. He falls in love with one of the wives. This all happens in our show. And then Furiosa and Max do agree to turn back. So they have to go back the way they came, essentially fighting the same battle a second time. Furiosa's huge, injured. She's clearly falling in love with Max as they're journeying back. I don't think I'm spoiling anything. They do manage to make it home, but people die along the way. They succeed in overcoming Joe and his incredible, forceful army. And we have a sense that she's returning to restore some order to the world that she left behind, and liberating the people there and turning back on the water, which is the resource that they are missing.
Wow. Sounds like an easy hour of theater.
We do all that in an hour with dancers and music.
My gosh. And just distilling this down must be the challenge. I mean, which things to actually illustrate from the dancers and then to have come to life with the music of James Jackson and mm-hmm. the folks at Yasu. Wow. James, can you tell us a little bit about the music that's been created? Is this a combination of live music and pre-recorded stuff?
Yeah, it's all live music. We treated it very much as if we were soundtracking a film. So it's one continuous play. It's 1 hour of nonstop sound.
Wow.
There's a lot of soundscapes, industrial noises in there. As well as we interspersed some more traditional songs in order to add some dialogue and help the story along. So Lily, the lead singer, plays one of the wives in the show, and she also sings some more traditional songs from her perspective and sort of acts as a narrator. And then the middle part, the Green World section, is a piece by the composer Christina Dutton and is performed by a live string quartet. So yeah, there's 10 people, 10 musicians on stage, full rock band, full percussion, two guitars, and then a full string quartet as well.
Wow, and this is for two performances only this Friday and Saturday at 8 at August Hall here on Mason Street in San Francisco. Wow, it sounds like it's being billed as immersive. How is that being fulfilled, an immersive evening of theater?
Mm-hmm. So it's performed in the round, which means the stage is thrust out into the middle of the audience. The band is actually on the normal stage, and then the singers and the dancers travel through the band and out onto a round stage in the middle of the audience. So you very much have a sense that you're sort of in the room with the dancers and the singers and the musicians. And then also we have video projections around the outside of the room. So that's also helping create a sense of being in the environment. And that's really, we wanted the audience to very much feel like they were part of the experience. It was going on around them, and that they could, really be close to the performers and see them as, real people.
Mm. And tell us about the dancers that you that have been chosen for this, mm-hmm. and how many were you going to see on stage?
Mm-hmm. There's 7 dancers total. We had three of them really are the leads from Alonzo King Line's ballet. Aji Sissoko, as I said, plays Furiosa. She's incredibly tall, statuesque, beautiful, stunning dancer. Baba Tunji plays Max. And then Michael Montgomery plays the character of Nux, as I mentioned before. We originally created the show with 4 principal dancers from San Francisco Ballet. Because they're in season right now, those roles are being danced by some guests. But the SF Ballet dancers that were part of creating the show in the original performances in September were Luke Ingham, played Morton Joe, the bad guy. Francis Chung played Keeper of the Seeds, now danced by Britt Juline. Doris Andre played a character named Toast, who is now danced by a beautiful dancer named Katarina Eng. And Jen Stahl played a character named Splendid, who is now danced by a dancer named Ramona Kelly.
Wow. Two performances only, furyshow.com. You can see a trailer as well as some of the amazing dance creations and the great music of Yasu and others, some of which we're hearing in the background now. James Jackson, very instrumental, so to speak, in the creation of that soundtrack. James, Kate, thanks so much for coming in, and it sounds like an amazing show.
Thank you.
Fury Mad Max is at August Hall here in San Francisco, 420 Mason Street, this Friday and Saturday. The San Francisco Chronicle calls Fury spinning a one-hour survivalist romance that leaves classical fairy tales in the dust. FurySHow.com for more information about that. But I'm keeping up my promises now. The soundtrack live performed for Fury Mad Max. Again, two performances only. Not only the Yasu indie pop band, a full rock band, plus a full string quartet presented as part of these two performances tomorrow and Saturday at 8, August Hall, 420 Mason Street in San Francisco. FuryShow.com for more information. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome Tony Drama Desk and Obie Award-winning Pam McKinnon to Open Air. She has recently been installed as our new artistic director of ACT and is now making her directorial debut as well for the current production of Edward Albee's Seascape, which opened last night to a rapturous audience, myself among them. She's directed some 11 plays by Edward Albee, including the iconic Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, for which she won the aforementioned Tony and Drama Desk Awards, as well as an Outer Critics Circle nomination for the 2012-13 season. Albee's A Delicate Balance, the play about the baby, The Goat, or Who is Sylvia, also in her Albee wheelhouse, and she maintains a close relationship with the now 88-year-old playwright. No, she doesn't. She's shaking her head.
Well, because he died 2 years ago.
Oh, no. I was just reading. I thought he was still with us.
No.
Oh, no. I missed that.
But he and I were dear friends.
Oh, and that's wonderful correspondence that is included as part of the program. Seascape stars Ellen McLaughlin and James Carpenter as the very human couple of Nancy and Charlie, and Sean Gallagher and Sarah Nina Hayon as the, how shall I say it, less than human doesn't really seem right because they are very human in some ways, in their language and mannerisms. Nonetheless, they are human-sized lizards. Lots to talk about. Welcome, Pam.
Thank you.
Forgive my earlier mistake about the dearly recently departed Edward Albee. Tell us a little bit about him. You had such a great relationship with him.
Yeah, absolutely. I knew Edward starting, I guess, in 2001. I was asked to direct a play of his, the play about the baby, which was a then very new play, for a company in Philadelphia, and my agent at the time, set up a lunch for Edward and me to have. And it was a great way to meet, you know, such an iconic theater artist in that we had something to talk about. We had his play to talk about. And we hit it off, and he started to come by my rehearsal hall. This was when he was in rehearsal for The Goat for Broadway, and also a revival of a play of his called All Over for the McCarter Theater, which happened to rehearse also in New York. And my little, you know, production of a play for a Philadelphia company, play about the baby, was also rehearsing in New York. And he just put me in his little black book and would show up once a week. So we got to know each other the best way that a director and a writer should get to know each other. It's not like I met Edward at some fancy party and, mm-hmm. you know, to chat with an icon would have made me nervous. But I was chatting with a playwright about a play of his. So that's how we got to know each other.
I understand that he was quite a stickler about showing up to various productions of his own plays to make sure that people were sticking strictly to his words.
Well, I mean, most playwrights, if the schedule allows, you know, will want to see what's going on in rehearsal halls. I mean, Edward was no exception to that. What was great in getting to know him. I was working on then very current plays of his, plays that he was still very interested in, having only seen one or two, and then ultimately started to direct world premieres by him. So, you know, first off plays. I fully recognize as a young director if my entree had been Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf or A Delicate Balance or even Seascape, you know, the 45, 50-year-old plays of his, I probably never would have met him.
Wow, that's interesting. And you've got quite a cast that's been assembled for this. Now, was this your choice of play for your directorial debut?
Of course. This whole season was, you know, a big part in choosing this inaugural season of mine.
Is this the most unusual of Albee's plays, would you say? Or?
No.
No? Okay.
No. I mean, you know, his plays, you know, sort of run an interesting gambit. Like, I think the themes kind of hold steady. There's something, you know, about sort of a core identity. He writes a lot of marriage plays. He writes a lot of plays that really question what are you going to do with the limited time that you have. Mm-hmm. But they run the gambit from, you know, very, very surreal. Like there's a play called Box that is a recorded monologue. I mean, it's sort of a little bit like Crap's Last Tape. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's sort of, there's a play.
Nothing else with lizards, though.
No, nothing with lizards. I mean, you know, Edward wrote with specific types of theaters in mind. And I do think Seascape was written. I know it was written for a Broadway style house, which is what the Geary is at ACT. So it has that muscle for a big room, but that surrealistic touch is also sort of bred in the bone of what he was after. He loved the theatrical. His plays, I mean, there's, you know, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf certainly is an interesting movie, but it's a much better play. You know, there's something about live and storytelling and anything is possible that was a big part of who he was as an artist.
Hmm. Let's delve a little deeper into these lizards and the story that Albee is telling on this. Long before these human-sized lizards appear, it's setting a very ordinary scene of a newly retired couple, Nancy and Charlie characters, and how they're just dealing with the everyday, and as Albee himself said, of the what's next. Mm-hmm. And so we're convinced this is not very extraordinary day out on the beach, and with the very realism intrusion of the sound and shadow of an airplane going over several times, and then the things change. The lizards appear.
Right.
I don't know where I'm going with
that. Yeah. So
it's almost like a Twilight Zone episode or a Planet of the Apes in a certain respect.
Yeah. I mean, we talked a lot about in rehearsal how Nancy and Charlie are having, I think it is a very pivotal conversation about like what is next, right? And a bit of a marriage in crisis, at least conversationally, about Charlie being, quote, happy to be doing nothing. And Nancy demanding that they do something, that you can't just do nothing, and she's expecting a new chapter in their life that is active, and that is a moment of crisis. I mean, it's a moment of re-upping and renegotiation. And we talked a lot about in rehearsal how the other couple, Leslie and Sarah, are lizards. While Nancy and Charlie are having that 35-minute conversation above ground, Leslie and Sarah are having a really comparable discussion underwater, or on another sand dune in the distance. And it is about what are we going to do next? I mean, there's definitely the theme of evolution in this play, both in terms of evolution of self and evolution of a marriage. Evolution between, you know, two people in a partnership.
Evolution with a capital E.
And then evolution with a capital E, right? Yeah. There's sort of like the micro personal, how do we evolve as you go through life? And then there's the capital E evolution of a species getting bored. A board underwater. I mean, that's what Sarah eventually says, that they felt like they didn't belong anymore in their surroundings. And so what next? So they've decided to come on shore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, also key to the story is our common language and how we may reinterpret certain words, phrases, or basic understandings.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. In talking, the interpersonal conversation between the human couple and the lizard couple, they wind up having to talk about fundamentals and sort of go to first principles. And one of the first principles discussed is like, what is love? How do you define love? And these lizards, while they have deep command of language, they are missing some fundamentals, including this notion of emotions. And one of the core emotions, which I also think is a prime sort of Albee territory, is what is love? And it's interesting to me, and this shows up in a number of his plays, that in order to understand love, you also have to understand loss. You know, he deals a lot with necessary opposites. You know, in order to make the most out of your life, you have to understand that it is a finite time. In order to understand what you're feeling toward someone as love, you also need to be able to imagine what it would be like in their absence. And that's in a lot of his plays.
Mm. It's a wonderful conversation, too, with the lizard wife and the wife of Charlie, talking about raising children. What do you mean, raising children? How many children do you have?
Yeah.
Well, I've had one or two. And Sarah, the lizard, has had 7,000 eggs.
Yeah.
And what do you mean you raise them? Well,
right.
Again, a common language, but a different understanding of some certain things.
Yeah. And it really points to, you know, if you look at the world through, in that moment, those lizard character eyes. I mean, Leslie the lizard, when he's told that human young are raised for 18 or 20 years, he says, well, that is ludicrous. I mean, think about it. That is a ludicrous notion.
Yeah.
And it kind of is, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Indeed. Well, we have to give some shout outs to the scenic and costume designer, David Zinn, who made this amazingly beautiful set, recreating a multi-story sand dune on the stage of the Geary. Who else would you like to give some props to in terms of the creation of the visuals?
I mean, certainly, you know, David with the sand dune, but also David designing those lizard costumes, and you know, it took a village to make those costumes. So, you know, my incredible artisans at the ACT costume shop, both, you know, costume painters as well as, you know, those actors are wearing, you know, sort of like muscle padding and an undergarment that is, you know, specifically fitted to them. We went through a variety of different kinds of shoes in order to make those look not like shoes but like feet.
Uh-huh.
You know, the like I'd say about eight people had, you know, truly hands-on contact making those costumes. So that, you know, that's very gratifying. Also, you know, I'm incredibly proud of this acting company. You know, Jim Carpenter, fantastic, well-known throughout the Bay Area actor. When we started rehearsals, he was performing Scrooge in the evening, but, you know, somehow with full attention, you know, diving into the character of Charlie.
Had he played the character before?
Charlie? No.
Wow.
No, none of us had any experience with this play.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So this is your 11th Albee production.
It's my 11th production, but the 8th play that I've directed of his.
Have you therefore developed a sort of instinct on how actors are going to behave initially and then how you have to maybe tweak them?
I mean,
specifically for an Edward Albee play.
I mean, I definitely recognize that bread in the bone of any Albee play is a big sense of humor, a big sense of irony. His characters, even if they aren't, like these lizards aren't necessarily the most articulate, but they use language really specifically. At times, his characters have sort of a dispassionate or ironic take, which lets them kind of say anything. You know, I mean that sometimes with the human couple in this play, Nancy and Charlie, I mean, they can go to really deep, interesting places that perhaps in a different play world would demand that, like, the play stop. You know, Nancy at one point says, you know, did I ever tell you that there was a week when I thought of divorcing you? And that's just a conversation that Charlie can actually listen to and Nancy can continue with, whereas in another play world, you know, pots and pans would be flying. These people can say anything to each other.
Mm-hmm. And you also have the incredible Ellen McLaughlin playing Nancy, along with James Carpenter as Charlie, Sean Gallagher, and Sarah Nina Hayon as the lizard couple. The show runs through, let me see if I have a date here. I don't in front
February
of me.
17th.
February 17th. Thank you. act-sf.org for more information. In part of the programming, I saw a wonderful quote from Edward Albee that he says, art is not pacification, it's disturbance. You either affect people or you leave them indifferent, and I would loathe to leave an audience indifferent. I don't care whether they like it or hate it, so long as they're not indifferent.
Yeah, I mean, words to live by.
Words to live by. I understand from a new member of the ACT board, who's a friend of mine, Rodman Merrymore, that you're keen on expanding the public's understanding of ACT as an institution.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, ACT has such wide reach within the community. We have, you know, an amazing education and a community outreach department, you know, programming that takes ACT into downtown high school, Ida B. Wells High School. I recently had the opportunity to sit in on a third grade classroom at the Bessie Carmichael School, and, you know, bringing in theater artists, teaching artists. I mean, that's a big part of ACT that I don't think necessarily people in San Francisco know about. We also have a fully accredited Master of Fine Arts actor training program, which, you know, has national recognition. It's super exciting. You know, there's something about ACT. It's, you know, conservatory is its middle name. And there's something really exciting. You know, we sort of consider ourselves something of a teaching hospital vis-a-vis theater. So it's professionals and students, you know, in like side by side in studio rehearsal halls, side by side using these great performance spaces that we have. Feels like it's, a giant cultural institution, and in some respects, our main stage programming only scratches the surface.
Well, we look forward to your guidance on that front, and we look forward to the rest of the season. We don't have a time to discuss the entire season, but tell us what you're really jazzed about coming up after Seascape.
Well, in rehearsal right now is a fantastic play, actually written by an MFA graduate, Emphanisa Odofia, who graduated from ACT, I think, in 2009, and her play, her portmanteau, will be playing at the Strand Theater in a matter of weeks. And it's, you know, a great pleasure of mine. I've been a freelance director my entire career, but now as a producer to get to really celebrate ambition. And Mfanisa Odofia, as a playwright, set herself a task of writing a 9-play family cycle. And she made it very publicly known that she was in the process of writing a 9-play family cycle prior to having put pen to paper. She is now 6 plays in. We're producing play number 5. The Magic Theater is producing play number 6 in tandem. So, you know, this great artist will have 2 plays running, back-to-back chapters of this cycle. We've also commissioned her 8th play. So hope to see that in coming seasons. So that's super exciting. It's about a Nigerian-American family. The play, Her Portmanteau, is a mother-daughter story. One daughter who was raised in the States, the other daughter raised in Nigeria. It's very much an immigrant story and a very complicated immigrant story. Very excited about that. Also, I know on your show today you spoke to Lauren Yee. We're about to produce a fantastic basketball play of hers at the Geary. Called The Great Leap, and B.D. Wong, hometown B.D. Wong actor, is coming back.
Fantastic.
To, yeah, it's super, super exciting. So to have, you know, Lauren and B.D., you know, in San Francisco, Lauren is going to be the first Asian-American woman playwright to ever be produced on the Geary stage. That feels exciting to me.
Wow, that's something that I'd love to have you all on to talk about next
time.
Yeah,
fantastic.
Appropriately, you're going to hear a little bit of Benjamin Britten to go out of this segment, his 4 Sea Interludes. Seascape is at the Geary Theater through act-sf.org for more information. Pam McKinnon, look forward to another conversation soon.
Nice, thank you.
The Sea Interludes happen to be being performed tonight at Zellerbach Hall in San Francisco, in Berkeley, for the Berkeley Symphonies concert under the direction of Joseph Young. Guest conductor Joseph Young takes the podium for Britten and Bernstein, a tribute to the composer's response to the written word. The concert opens with Berkeley Symphony's first performance of Benjamin Britten's 4C Interludes from Peter Grimes. We'll then present the world premiere of Disillusioned Dreamer, a newly commissioned orchestral piece by Hannah Kendall, inspired by a phrase from Ralph Ellison's novel Invisible Man. And Bay Area actor Michael Asbury will join Maestro Young on stage to recite a selection of the novel, which is a landmark work exploring the African-American experience. And Leonard Bernstein's Symphony No. 2 for Piano and Orchestra, The Age of Anxiety, how appropriate for this time, is also on the program tonight at 8 in Zellerbach Hall. Also on the docket for cultural offerings, tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday at 8, conductor laureate of the San Francisco Symphony, Herbert Blomstedt, returns to the podium for Beethoven's 6th Symphony, the Pastorale, and Mendelssohn's 3rd Symphony, the Scottish. Do catch that, sfsymphony.org. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. My thanks to producer Neil Swinkles. And if you have any comments, by all means, send me an email, david@kalw.org. Let's hear a little bit more Britten now. Thanks for listening today. Music of Benjamin Britten. You can hear the full Sea Interludes of his from Peter Grimes tonight, Zellerbach Hall, the Berkeley Symphony, berkeleysymphony.org for more information.